This is Audible.
Life is difficult. This is a great truth, one of the greatest truths. Yet once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters.
In the following AudioWorks presentation, Dr. Scott Peck will read from his best-selling book, The Road Less Traveled. A Harvard graduate, Dr. Peck was formerly a practicing psychiatrist and medical director of the New Milford Hospital Mental Health Clinic. He now devotes over 200 days a year to speaking and conducting workshops on psychospiritual issues. His other best-selling books include People of the Lie and What Return Can I Make? Dr. Peck.
Life is a series of problems. Discipline is the basic set of tools we require to solve life's problems. Without discipline, we can solve nothing. With total discipline, we can solve all problems. What makes life difficult is that solving problems is painful. Problems evoke in us frustration or grief or sadness or loneliness or guilt or regret or anger or fear or anxiety or anguish or despair. These are uncomfortable feelings, sometimes equaling the very worst kind of physical pain. And since life poses an endless series of problems, life is full of pain as well as joy. Yet it is in meeting and solving problems that life has its meaning. Problems are the cutting edge that distinguishes between success and failure. Problems call forth our courage and our wisdom. Indeed, they create our courage and our wisdom. It is only because of problems that we grow mentally and spiritually. Wise people learn not to dread, but actually to welcome problems and the pain of problems. Most of us are not so wise. Fearing the pain involved, almost all of us attempt to avoid problems. This tendency to avoid problems and the emotional suffering inherent in them is the primary psychological basis of all mental illness. Since most of us have this tendency to a greater or lesser degree, most of us are mentally ill to a greater or lesser degree. Some of us will go to extraordinary lengths to avoid our problems and the suffering they cause, building the most elaborate fantasies in which to live. Sometimes to the total exclusion of reality. In the words of Carl Jung, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. But the substitute itself ultimately becomes more painful than the legitimate suffering it was designed to avoid. The neurosis itself becomes the biggest problem. True to form, many will then attempt to avoid this pain and this problem in turn, building layer upon layer of neurosis. When we avoid the legitimate suffering that results from dealing with problems, we also avoid the growth that problems demand from us. In chronic mental illness, we stop growing. We become stuck. And without healing, the human spirit begins to shrivel. Therefore, let us inculcate in ourselves and in our children the means of achieving mental and spiritual health. Let us teach ourselves and our children the need to face problems directly and to experience the pain involved. I have stated that discipline is the basic set of tools we require to solve life's problems. When we teach ourselves and our children discipline, we are teaching them and ourselves how to suffer and also how to grow. What are these tools I call discipline? There are four. Delaying of gratification, acceptance of responsibility, dedication to truth, and balancing. These are simple tools. And almost all children are adept in their use by the age of 10. Yet presidents and kings will often forget to use them to their downfall. The problem lies in the will to use them, for they are tools with which pain is confronted rather than avoided. And if one seeks to avoid legitimate suffering, then one will avoid the use of these tools. First, I want to talk about delaying gratification. Not too long ago, a 30-year-old financial analyst was complaining to me about her tendency to procrastinate in her job. Finally, one day, we dared to look at the obvious. "Do you like cake?" I asked her. She replied that she did. "Which part of the cake do you like better?" I went on. "The cake or the frosting?" "Oh, the frosting," she responded enthusiastically. "And how do you eat a piece of cake?" I inquired. "I eat the frosting first, of course," she replied. From her cake-eating habits, we went on to examine her work habits and discovered that on any given workday, she would devote the first hour to the more gratifying half of her work and the remaining 6 hours getting around to the objectionable remainder. I suggested that if she were to force herself to accomplish the unpleasant part during the first hour, she would then be free to enjoy the other six. It seemed to me, I said, that 1 hour of pain, followed by six of pleasure, was preferable to 1 hour of pleasure, followed by six of pain. She agreed, and being basically a person of strong will, she no longer procrastinates. Delaying gratification is a process of scheduling the pain and pleasure of life to enhance the pleasure by experiencing the pain first and getting it over with. It is the only decent way to live. This process of scheduling is learned by most children quite early in life. Throughout grammar school, this capacity to delay gratification is daily exercised through the performance of homework. By the age of 12, some children are already able to sit down without prompting and complete their homework before they watch television. By the age of 15 or 16, such behavior is considered normal. However, some 15 or 16-year-olds seem to have hardly developed this capacity to delay gratification. Some seem to lack the capacity entirely. These are the problem students. Despite average or better intelligence, their grades are poor simply because they do not work. They skip classes or skip school entirely, and their impulsiveness spills over into their social life. They get into frequent fights. They become involved with drugs. They get in trouble with the police. "Play now, pay later," is their motto. So the psychologists and psychotherapists are called in. But most of the time, it seems too late. These adolescents resent any attempt to intervene in their lifestyle of impulsiveness. And even when this resentment can be overcome by friendliness and a non-judgmental attitude, their impulsiveness precludes their participation in psychotherapy in any meaningful way. They miss their appointments. They avoid all the painful issues. So usually these children drop out of school, only to continue a pattern of failure that frequently lands them in disastrous marriages, in accidents, in psychiatric hospitals, or in jail. Why is this? Why do a majority develop a capacity to delay gratification, while a substantial minority fail? Most of the signs point to the quality of parenting as the determinant. It is not that the homes of these unself-disciplined children are lacking in parental discipline of a sort. More often than not, these children are punished frequently and severely. Slapped, punched, kicked, beaten, and whipped for even minor infractions. But this discipline is meaningless because it is undisciplined discipline. The parents themselves are unself-disciplined and therefore serve as undisciplined role models for their children. They are the do-as-I-say, not-as-I-do parents. They may frequently get drunk in front of their children. They may fight in front of the children without restraint or rationality. They may be slovenly. They make promises they don't keep. Their own lives are in disorder, and their attempts to order the lives of their children, therefore, make little sense to these children. If father beats up mother regularly, what sense does it make to a boy when he's told to control his temper? When parents do things a certain way, it seems to the young child the way that they should be done. If a child sees his parents behaving with self-discipline, restraint, and dignity, then the child will come to feel that this is the way to live. If a child sees his parents living without self-restraint or self-discipline, then he will believe that that is the way to live. Yet even more important than role modeling is love. For even in chaotic homes, genuine love is occasionally present, and from such homes may come self-disciplined children. And not infrequently, parents who are professional people, doctors, lawyers, club women, and philanthropists, who lead lives of strict order and decorum, but lack love, send children into the world who are as undisciplined and destructive as any child from an impoverished and chaotic home. Ultimately, love is everything. When we love something, it is of value to us. And when something is of value to us, we spend time enjoying it and taking care of it. Observe a teenager in love with his car, and note the time he will spend admiring it, polishing it, repairing it, tuning it. Or an older person with a beloved rose garden, and the time spent pruning and mulching and fertilizing. So it is when we love children. We spend time admiring them and caring for them. We give them our time. Good discipline requires time. When we have no time to give our children, or no time that we are willing to give, we don't observe them closely enough to become aware of their need for our disciplinary assistance when it is expressed subtly. If their need for discipline is gross, if we are impelled into action by their misdeeds and our irritation, we will impose discipline out of anger rather than deliberation, without examining the problem or even taking the time to consider which form of discipline is the most appropriate. Parents who devote time to their children, even when it is not demanded by glaring misdeeds, will perceive in them subtle needs for discipline, to which they will respond with gentle urging or reprimand or praise, administered with thoughtfulness and care. They will observe how their children eat cake, how they study, when they tell subtle falsehoods, when they run away from problems rather than face them. They will take time to make minor corrections and adjustments, listening, responding, tightening a little here, loosening a little there, giving little lectures, little stories, little hugs and kisses, little admonishments, little pats on the back. In taking time to observe and think about their children's needs, loving parents will frequently agonize over decisions. In a very real sense, they will suffer along with their children. The children are not blind to this. If my parents are willing to suffer with me, they will think, then suffering must not be so bad, and I should be willing to suffer with myself. This is the beginning of self-discipline. The time and quality of the time that their parents devote to them indicate to children the degree to which they are valued by their parents. Some basically unloving parents, to cover up their lack of caring, make frequent professions of love to their children. But children are never totally deceived by hollow words. Consciously, they may want to believe that they are loved. But unconsciously, they know that their parents' words do not match up with their deeds. On the other hand, children who are truly loved know themselves to be valued. This knowledge is worth more than gold. For when children truly feel valued, they feel valuable. The feeling of being valuable, I am a valuable person, is essential to mental health, and is a direct product of parental love. Such a conviction must be gained in childhood. It is extremely difficult to acquire during adulthood. Conversely, when children have learned through the love of their parents to feel valuable, it is almost impossible for the vicissitudes of adulthood to destroy their spirit. This feeling of being valuable is a cornerstone of self-discipline, because when one considers oneself valuable, one will take care of oneself in all ways that are necessary. Self-discipline is self-caring. For instance, if we feel ourselves valuable, then we will feel our time to be valuable, and we will want to use it well. The financial analyst who procrastinated did not value her time. If she had, she would not have spent most of her day so unhappily and unproductively. Once she was able to perceive her time as being valuable, it naturally followed that she wanted to make maximum use of it. As a result of consistent parental love and caring, fortunate children enter adulthood not only with a deep internal sense of their own value, but also with a deep internal sense of security. All children are terrified of abandonment, and with good reason. This fear begins around the age of 6 months, as soon as the child can perceive itself to be an individual separate from its parents. For with this perception of itself as an individual comes the realization that it is quite helpless, totally dependent on its parents for all forms of sustenance. To the child, abandonment by its parents is the equivalent of death. Most parents are instinctively sensitive to their children's fear of abandonment, and will therefore offer needed reassurance. Mummy and Daddy aren't going to leave you. If words are matched by deeds, by the time of adolescence, the child will have lost the fear of abandonment and will have a deep inner feeling that the world is a safe place. With this internal sense of the consistent safety of the world, such a child is free to delay gratification, secure in the knowledge that the opportunity for gratification, like home and parents, is always there. But a substantial number of children actually are abandoned by their parents by death, by desertion, by sheer negligence, or a simple lack of caring. Others, while not abandoned in fact, fail to receive reassurance that they will not be abandoned. Some parents will actually use the threat of abandonment, overtly or subtly. The message they give to their children is, "If you don't do exactly what I want you to do, I won't love you anymore." And you can figure out for yourself what that might mean. It means, of course, abandonment and death. These parents sacrifice love in their need for domination over their children, and their reward is children who are excessively fearful. These children, abandoned either psychologically or in actuality, enter adulthood lacking any deep sense that the world is a safe and protective place. They perceive the world as dangerous and frightening, and they are not about to forsake any gratification or security in the present for the promise of greater gratification or security in the future, since for them the future seems dubious indeed. In summary, for children to develop the capacity to delay gratification, it is necessary for them to have self-disciplined role models, a sense of self-worth, and a degree of trust in the safety of their existence. These possessions are ideally acquired through the self-discipline and the consistent, genuine caring of their parents. They are the most precious gifts that mothers and fathers can bequeath. When these gifts have not been proffered by one's parents, it is possible to acquire them from other sources, but the process is invariably an uphill struggle, often of lifelong duration and often unsuccessful. Now I'd like to talk about problem solving and time. At the age of 37, I learned how to fix things. Prior to that, almost all my attempts to make minor plumbing repairs, mend toys, or assemble box furniture according to the hieroglyphical instruction sheet ended in confusion, failure, and frustration. I considered myself a mechanical idiot, deficient in some gene responsible for mechanical ability. Then one day, I happened upon a neighbor repairing a lawnmower. "I sure admire you," I said. "I've never been able to do anything like that." My neighbor shot back, "That's because you don't take the time." The guru-like simplicity and definitiveness of his response somehow registered, and the next time I had to make a minor repair, I was able to remind myself to take time. The parking brake was stuck on a patient's car, and she knew that there was something one could do under the dashboard to release it. I lay down on the floor below the front seat, and took the time to look at the situation for several minutes. At first, all I saw was a jumble of wires and tubes and rods. But gradually, I was able to focus on the brake apparatus and trace its course. Then it became clear that there was a little latch preventing the brake from being released, and that if I were to push it upward, it would release the brake. I did this. One single motion, 1 ounce of pressure from a fingertip, and the problem was solved. Actually, I don't begin to have the knowledge or the time to fix most mechanical failures, so I still usually go running to the nearest repairman. But now I know that this is a choice I make, that I am not cursed or genetically defective, and I know that I and anyone else who is not mentally defective can solve any problem if we are willing to take the time. The issue is important because most people simply do not take the time necessary to solve many of life's intellectual, social, or spiritual problems. Before my mechanical enlightenment, I would have awkwardly stuck my head under the dashboard, yanked at a few wires, and then thrown up my hands and proclaimed, "It's beyond me." This is precisely the way so many of us approach other dilemmas of day-to-day living. The financial analyst was a basically loving and dedicated mother to her 2 young children. She was alert and concerned enough to perceive when her children were having some sort of emotional problem. But then she either made the very first change that came to her mind, making them eat more breakfast or sending them to bed earlier, regardless of whether such a change had anything to do with the problem. Or she came to her next therapy session with me, the repairman, despairing. "It's beyond me. What shall I do?" This woman had a perfectly keen analytical mind and was quite capable of solving complex problems at work. Yet when confronted with a personal problem, she behaved as if she were totally lacking in intelligence. The issue was one of time. Once she became aware of a personal problem, she felt discomforted and was not willing to tolerate her discomfort long enough to analyze the problem. The solution to the problem represented gratification to her, but she was unable to delay this gratification for more than a minute or two, with the result that her solutions were usually inappropriate, and her family in chronic turmoil. We are not talking here about esoteric defects in problem-solving associated only with psychiatric disturbances. The financial analyst is every man. Who among us are so self-disciplined that they unfailingly devote sufficient time to analyzing problems within the family? Who among us never says resignedly, "It's beyond me"? Actually, there is a defect in the approach to problem solving more primitive and more destructive than impatient attempts to find instant solutions. A defect even more universal. It is the hope that problems will go away of their own accord. A 30-year-old single salesman in group therapy in a small town began to date the recently separated wife of another group member, a banker. The salesman knew the banker to be a chronically angry man who was deeply resentful of his wife's leaving him. He knew that he was not being honest, either with a group or with a banker, by not confiding his relationship with the banker's wife. He also knew that it was almost inevitable that sooner or later the banker would learn about the relationship. He knew that the only solution to the problem would be to confess to the group and bear the banker's anger with the group's support. But he did nothing. After 3 months, the banker found out about the relationship, was predictably enraged, and used the incident to quit his therapy. When confronted by the group, the salesman said, "I knew that talking about it would be a hassle, and I guess I felt that if I did nothing, maybe I could get away with it without the hassle. I guess I thought that if I waited long enough, the problem might go away." The group made the salesman aware, in no uncertain terms, that his tendency to ignore a problem in the hope that it would go away was itself his major problem. Problems do not go away, They must be worked through, or else they remain, forever a barrier to the growth and development of the spirit. The inclination to ignore problems is a simple manifestation of unwillingness to delay gratification. Confronting problems is painful. To willingly confront a problem before we are forced to confront it by circumstances means to put aside something pleasant or less painful for something more painful. It is choosing to suffer now in the hope of future gratification, rather than choosing to continue present gratification in the hope that future suffering will not be necessary. A great general, commander of an army, once told me, "The single greatest problem in this army is that most executives will sit looking at problems, staring them right in the face, doing nothing, as if these problems will go away if they sit there long enough." The general wasn't talking about the mentally weak or abnormal. He was talking about other generals and senior colonels, mature men of proven capability, trained in discipline. Parents are executives, and their task can be every bit as complex as directing a corporation. Like the army executives, most parents will perceive problems in their children or in their relationship with their children for months or years before they take effective action, if they ever do. "We thought maybe he would grow out of it," parents say. Children often do grow out of it, but often they do not. And as with so many problems, the longer children's problems are ignored, the larger they become, and the more painful and difficult to solve. Which brings me to the subject of responsibility. We must accept responsibility for a problem before we can solve it. We cannot solve a problem by saying, "It's not my problem." We cannot solve a problem by hoping someone else will solve it for us. I can solve a problem only when I say, "This is my problem, and it's up to me to solve it." But many seek to avoid the pain of their problems by saying to themselves, "This problem was caused by other people or by social circumstances beyond my control, and therefore it is up to other people or society to solve this problem for me." The extent to which people will go to avoid assuming responsibility for personal problems is sometimes almost ludicrous. A career sergeant, because of excessive drinking, was referred for psychiatric assistance. He denied that he was an alcoholic or even that his use of alcohol was a personal problem, saying, "There's nothing to do in the evenings in Okinawa except drink." "Do you like to read?" I asked. "Oh, yeah." "Well, then why don't you read in the evening instead of drinking?" "It's too noisy to read in the barracks." "Well, why don't you go to the library?" "The library's too far away." "Further away than the bar you go to?" "Well," he said, "I'm not much of a reader." "Do you like to fish?" I asked. "Sure, I love to fish." "Why not go fishing instead of drinking?" "Because I have to work all day long." "Can't you fish at night?" "There isn't any night fishing in Okinawa." "But there is," I said. "I know several organizations that fish at night here. Would you like me to put you in touch with them?" "Well, I really don't like to fish." "What I hear you saying," I clarified, "is that there are other things to do in Okinawa except drink, but the thing you like to do most in Okinawa is drink." "I guess so. But your drinking is getting you in trouble. So you're faced with a real problem, aren't you?" "This damn island would drive anyone to drink." The sergeant was not the least bit interested in seeing his drinking as a personal problem he could solve, with or without help, and I regretfully told his commander that he was not amenable to assistance. His drinking continued, and he was separated from the service in mid-career. A young wife, also in Okinawa, cut her wrist lightly and was brought to the emergency room. I asked her why she had done this. "To kill myself, of course." "Why do you want to kill yourself?" "Because I can't stand it on this dumb island." "What is it about Okinawa that's so painful?" I asked. She began to cry in a whining way. "I don't have any friends here." "That's too bad. How come you haven't been able to make friends?" "Because I have to live in a stupid Okinawan housing area, and none of my neighbors speak English." why don't you drive over to the American housing area during the day so you can make some friends? Because my husband has to drive the car to work. Can't you drive him to work? I asked. No, I don't know how to drive a stick shift car. Well, why don't you learn how? She glared at me. On these roads? You must be crazy. Most people who come to see a psychiatrist are suffering from what is called either a neurosis or a character disorder. These two conditions are disorders of responsibility, and they are opposite styles of relating to the world and its problems. The neurotic assumes too much responsibility. The person with a character disorder assumes not enough. When neurotics are in conflict with the world, they assume that they are at fault. When those with character disorders are in conflict with the world, they assume the world is at fault. The two individuals just described had character disorders. The sergeant felt that his drinking was Okinawa's fault, not his. And the wife also saw herself as playing no role in her own isolation. A neurotic woman, also suffering from loneliness and isolation on Okinawa, complained, I drive over to the non-commissioned officers' wives' club every day to look for friendship, but I don't feel at ease there. I think that the other wives don't like me. I want to find out what it is about me that makes me so unpopular. This woman assumed total responsibility for her loneliness, feeling she was entirely to blame. In the course of therapy, she found that she was ill at ease with the other sergeant's wives, as well as with her husband, because she was more intelligent and ambitious than they. She came to see that her loneliness was not necessarily due to a fault or defect. Ultimately, she was divorced, put herself through college while raising her children, became a magazine editor, and married a successful publisher. The speech patterns of neurotics are notable for such expressions as, I ought to, or I should, and I shouldn't, indicating the individual's self-image as an inferior man or woman. The speech of a person with a character disorder, however, relies heavily on, I can't, I couldn't, I have to, and I had to, demonstrating a self-image of a being who has no power of choice, whose behavior is completely directed by external forces totally beyond control. Neurotics are easy to work with in psychotherapy because they assume responsibility for their difficulties. Those with character disorders are much more difficult, if not impossible, because they don't see themselves as the source of their problem. They fail to recognize the necessity for self-examination. Many individuals have both a neurosis and a character disorder and are referred to as character neurotics. In some areas of their lives, they are guilt-ridden, having assumed a responsibility that is not really theirs, while in other areas of their lives, they fail to take realistic responsibility for themselves. The problem of distinguishing what we are and what we are not responsible for is one of the greatest problems of human existence. It is never completely solved. We must continually assess and reassess where our responsibilities lie in the ever-changing course of events. Nor is this assessment and reassessment painless. To perform adequately, we must be willing and able to suffer continual self-examination, and such capacity and willingness is not inherent in any of us. In a sense, all children have character disorders, in that their instinctual tendency is to deny responsibility for many conflicts. Two siblings fighting will always blame each other for initiating the fight. Similarly, all children have neuroses, in that they will instinctually assume responsibility for certain deprivations that they experience but do not yet understand. The child who is not loved by his parents will always assume himself or herself to be unlovable, rather than see the parents as deficient in love. Or early adolescents who are not yet successful at dating or at sports will see themselves as seriously deficient human beings, rather than the late but perfectly adequate bloomers they usually are. It is only through experience and maturation that we learn to see the world and our place in it realistically, to realistically assess our responsibility for ourselves and the world. There is much that parents can do to assist children in this maturation process. Opportunities arise thousands of times when parents can either confront them with their tendency to avoid responsibility or can reassure them that certain situations are not their fault. But to seize these opportunities requires a parent's sensitivity to their children's needs and willingness to take the time and make the often uncomfortable effort to meet these needs. And this, in turn, requires love and the willingness to assume appropriate responsibility for their children's growth. Conversely, there is much that many parents do to hinder this maturation process. Neurotics, because of their willingness to assume responsibility, may be excellent parents if they are not so overwhelmed by unnecessary responsibilities that they have scant energy left for the necessary responsibilities of parenthood. Character disordered people, however, make disastrous parents, blissfully unaware that they often treat their children with vicious destructiveness. It is said that neurotics make themselves miserable. Those with character disorders make everyone else miserable, especially their children. They tend to brush off their children rather than provide needed attention. When their children have difficulty in school, character disordered parents will automatically lay the blame on the school system or on the bad influence of other children. Because they duck responsibility, character disordered parents serve as role models of irresponsibility for their children. Finally, to avoid responsibility for their own lives, character disordered parents will often lay this responsibility upon their children. "You kids are driving me nuts." Or, "The only reason I stay married to your father is because of you kids." Or, "I could have gone to college and been a success if it weren't for having to support you." These parents, in effect, say to their children, "You are responsible for the quality of my marriage, my mental health, and my lack of success in life." Children will often accept this responsibility and become neurotic. Character-disordered parents almost invariably produce character-disordered or neurotic children. Character-disordered individuals are destructive in their marriages, their friendships, and their business dealings. When character-disordered individuals blame someone or something else for their problem, these problems persist. Nothing has been accomplished. By casting away their responsibility, they may feel comfortable with themselves, but they have ceased to grow spiritually and have become dead weight for society. They have cast their pain onto society. The saying of the 60s, attributed to Eldridge Cleaver, speaks to all of us. If you are not part of the solution, then you are part of the problem. For the cure of my own subtle character disorder at the age of 30, I am indebted to a man named Mac Badgley. Mac was the director of the outpatient psychiatric clinic where I was completing my psychiatry residency training. My fellow residents and I were assigned new patients on rotation. Perhaps because I was more dedicated than most of my fellow residents, I found myself working much longer hours. They ordinarily saw patients once a week. I often saw my patients two or three times a week. As a result, I would watch my fellow residents leaving the clinic at 4:30 each afternoon, while I was scheduled with appointments up to 8 or 9 at night, and my heart was filled with resentment. So I went to Dr. Badgley and explained the situation. I wondered whether I might be exempted from the rotation of accepting new patients for a while, so that I might have time to catch up. Mac listened intently. When I was finished, he said sympathetically, "Well, I can see that you do have a problem." "Thank you," I said. "What do you think should be done about it?" "I told you, Scott, you do have a problem." This was hardly the response I expected. "Yes," I said, slightly annoyed, "I know I have a problem. That's why I came to see you. What do you think I ought to do about it?" Mac responded, "Scott, apparently you haven't listened to what I said. I have heard you, and I am agreeing with you. You do have a problem." "Damn it," I said, "I know I have a problem. The question is, what am I going to do about it?" "Scott," Mac replied, "listen closely. I agree with you. You do have a problem, a problem with time. It's not my problem. It's your problem with your time. That's all I'm going to say. I strode out of Mac's office, furious. For 3 months, I hated Mac Badgley. I felt he had a severe character disorder. Here I had gone to him, humbly asking for just a little bit of help, and the bastard wasn't willing to assume enough responsibility even to do his job. But after 3 months, I somehow came to see that it was I, not he, who had the character disorder. My time was my responsibility. It was up to me and me alone to decide how I used my time. If I wanted to invest my time more heavily than my fellow residents in my work, then that was my choice. And the consequences of that choice were my responsibility. It might be painful to watch my fellow residents leave their offices 2 or 3 hours before me. And it might be painful to listen to my wife's complaints that I was not devoting myself sufficiently to the family. But my working hard was not a burden cast upon me by a hard-hearted fate or a hard-hearted clinic director. It was the way I had chosen to order my priorities. As it happened, I chose not to change my lifestyle. But with my change in attitude, my resentment vanished. It simply no longer made any sense to resent them for having chosen a lifestyle different from mine when I was completely free to be like them if I wanted to. To resent them was to resent my own choice to be different from them, a choice that I was happy with. The difficulty we have in accepting responsibility for our behavior lies in the desire to avoid the pain of the consequences of that behavior. By requesting Mac Badgley to assume responsibility for the structure of my time, I was trying to avoid the pain of working long hours. Even though working long hours was an inevitable consequence of my choice to be dedicated to my patients. I was also unwittingly seeking to increase Mac's authority over me. I was giving him my power, my freedom. I was saying, in effect, take charge of me. You be the boss. Whenever we seek to avoid the responsibility for our behavior, we attempt to give that responsibility to some other individual or organization. We give away our power to fate or society or the government or the corporation or our boss. In attempting to avoid the pain of responsibility, billions daily attempt to escape from freedom. As children, by virtue of our real and extensive dependency, our parents have real and extensive power over us. When parents are oppressive, we as children are largely powerless to do anything about it. Our choices are limited. But as adults, our choices are almost unlimited. That does not mean they are not painful. Frequently, our choices lie between the lesser of two evils. But it is still within our power to make these choices. Dr. Hilda Brook states that all patients come to psychiatrists with one common problem, the sense of helplessness, the fear and inner conviction of being unable to cope and to change things. One of the roots of this sense of impotence is some desire to escape the pain of freedom, and therefore some failure to accept responsibility for their problems. They feel impotent because they have given their power away. They must learn that adult life is a series of personal choices, decisions. If they can accept this totally, they become free people. To the extent that they do not accept this, they will forever feel themselves victims. The third tool of discipline, or technique of dealing with the pain of problem solving, is dedication to the truth. Truth is reality. That which is false is unreal. The more clearly we see the reality of the world, the better equipped we are to deal with the world. Our view of reality is like a map with which to negotiate the terrain of life. If the map is true and accurate, we will generally know where we are. And if we have decided where we want to go, we will generally know how to get there. If the map is false and inaccurate, we will generally be lost. This is something most people choose to ignore. They ignore it because our route to reality is not easy. We are not born with maps. We have to make them. And the making requires effort. The biggest problem of map making is that we have to continually revise our maps. The world itself is constantly changing. Even more dramatically, the vantage point from which we view the world is constantly and rapidly changing. When we are children, we are dependent, powerless. As adults, we may be powerful. Yet in illness or infirm old age, we may become powerless and dependent again. When we are poor, the world looks different from when we are rich. We are daily bombarded with new information about reality. If we are to incorporate this information, we must continually revise our maps. The process is painful. What happens when one has striven long and hard to develop a working view of the world and then is confronted with new information suggesting that the map needs to be largely redrawn? The effort required seems almost overwhelming. More often than not, we ignore the new information. Often we denounce the new information as false, dangerous, the work of the devil. Rather than to try to change the map, an individual may try to destroy the new reality. This process of active clinging to an outmoded view of reality is the basis for much mental illness. Psychiatrists refer to it as transference. Transference occurs when a set of ways of perceiving and responding to the world, developed in childhood and usually appropriate to the childhood environment, indeed, often life-saving, is inappropriately transferred into the adult environment. The ways in which transference manifests itself are always destructive. One patient, a brilliant but unsuccessful computer technician in his early 30s, came to see me because his wife had left him, taking their two children. He was not particularly unhappy to lose her, but he was devastated by the loss of his children. His wife's principal complaints were that he was irrationally jealous of her, and yet at the same time uncommunicative and unaffectionate. She also complained of his frequent changes of employment. His life had been markedly unstable. During adolescence, he had been jailed 3 times for intoxication, belligerence, and interfering with the duties of an officer. He dropped out of college, he said, because my teachers were a bunch of hypocrites. By virtue of his brilliance in computer technology, his services were in high demand, but he had never been able to keep a job for more than a year and a half, occasionally being fired, often quitting after disputes with his supervisors, whom he described as liars and cheats, interested only in protecting their own ass. His most frequent expression was, "You can't trust a damn soul." He described his childhood as normal and his parents as average. However, he casually and unemotionally recounted many childhood instances in which he suffered painful disappointments through his parents' lack of caring. In mid-childhood, he came to the agonizing realization that he could not trust his parents. Once he realized this, he began to feel better. He no longer got his hopes up when they made promises. When he stopped trusting his parents, his disappointments diminished dramatically. Such an adjustment, however, is the basis for future problems. To a child, his or her parents represent the world. He assumes that the way his parents do things is the way things are done. Consequently, the realization this child came to was not, "I can't trust my parents," but rather, "I can't trust people." Not trusting people became the map with which he entered adolescence and adulthood. With this map, and with an abundant store of resentment, it was inevitable that he came into conflict after conflict with authority figures, policemen, teachers, employers. and these conflicts only reinforced his feeling that people couldn't be trusted. He had many opportunities to revise his map, but they were all passed up. The only way he could learn that there were some people in the adult world he could trust would be to risk trusting them, and that would require of him to revise his map, to realize that his parents did not love him, and that he did not have a normal childhood. Such a realization would have been extremely painful. Finally, because his distrust of people was a realistic adjustment to the reality of his childhood, it was an adjustment that worked in terms of diminishing this pain and suffering. Since it is extremely difficult to give up an adjustment that once worked so well, he continued his course of distrust, unconsciously creating situations that served to reinforce it, alienating himself from everyone, making it impossible for him to enjoy love, warmth, intimacy, and affection. He could not even allow himself closeness with his wife. She, too, could not be trusted. The only people he could relate with intimately were his two children. They were the only ones over whom he had control, the only ones who had no authority over him, the only ones he could trust in the whole world. Insofar as problems of transference are involved, psychotherapy is a process of map revising. Patients come to therapy because their maps are clearly not working. But frequently their need to cling to their maps and fight against losing them is so great that therapy becomes impossible, as it did in the case of the computer technician. He stipulated that he could see me only on those Monday evenings when there was no overtime work to be done, and that he would call me at 4 o'clock every Monday afternoon to tell me if he could keep his appointment that evening. I told him I was unwilling to set aside my plans every Monday evening on the chance that he might be able to come to his sessions. He felt that I was interested only in my own time and clearly cared nothing for him, and that, therefore, I could not be trusted. Our attempt to work together was terminated, with me as another landmark on his old map. The problem of transference is not simply a problem between psychotherapists and their patients. It is a problem between parents and children, husbands and wives, employers and employees, between friends, and even between nations. Truth, or reality, is avoided when it is painful. We can revise our maps only when we have the discipline to overcome that pain. To have such discipline, we must be totally dedicated